From the Sky News Centre at 5, police are investigating threatening tweets sent to Jessica Ennis-Hill. It follows the Olympic athletics champion's statement that she'd want her name removed from a stand at Sheffield United if they offer convicted rapist Ched Evans a contract. They're letting the striker train with his former team after his release from prison. Plans to block some British terror suspects returning home from abroad have been set out by David Cameron in Australia, but they're already facing criticism, Simon English reports.
The Prime Minister's plans include banning suspected Islamic State jihadists from the UK for 2 years and cancelling their passports.
You need an additional set of powers in order to keep the country safe.
Names could also be added to a no-fly list, but former Attorney General Dominic Grieve says some plans may not work.
As a common law right and under international law, they must have an entitlement to come back to their own home.
Commons Speaker John Bercow's criticised the PM for announcing the plans while abroad.
A 64-year-old minibus driver has been sentenced to more than 6.5 years in prison after a fatal crash on the M62 in West Yorkshire. James Johnson admitted causing the death of an 18-year-old passenger last April. Detectives investigating allegations of historical child sex abuse say they're now looking into possible homicide. The operation had originally centred on claims of a paedophile ring with links to government. Nicola Sturgeon insists she's not ruling out a future Scottish independence referendum after officially taking over as leader of the SNP. Alex Salmond stood down following the country's decision to stay part of the UK, while Nicola Sturgeon believes Scotland will break away at some point.
I'll decide the content of our manifesto for the 2016 election at the appropriate moment. I'm not planning another referendum right now. We've just had one. But whether there is another referendum and when that happens will be down to circumstances and to the will of the people.
And the Philae space probe's begun drilling for samples on a comet despite scientists not knowing exactly where it settled. It's believed to be in the shadow of a cliff, leading to it running low on solar power. And that's the latest. I'm Glenn Moore.
Not all of us hate you, Sam.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news, it's Assistant Mayor No. 3 and Green Party Councillor for Ashley Ward, Gus Hoyt. Joining us for the first 20 minutes is Green Party Councillor for Redland 2, Martin Fordor. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, an exclusive interview with the award-winning journalist and TV documentary producer Tim Tate, who lives here in the southwest. In the early 1990s, he made an hour-long documentary, Conspiracy of Silence, for the Discovery Channel, about a care home, child prostitution and drug ring, with collusion by the FBI at the very top of the Republican Party in Nebraska and Washington, D.C., in the United States. After spending $500,000 making the documentary, which was legally watertight and there in the TV schedules, it was pulled by Discovery Channel. Although it's available online, it was never shown on television either in the UK or the US. Tim tells a story of how his documentary on Republican child sexual abusers was made and then closed down, and how the victims ended up dead or doing decades in jail while many of the perpetrators carried on their political careers. Also, tasers, another death in Wales last week. So we ask, is this technology developed for use in slaughterhouses appropriate to be deployed on our streets? And rumours of teenage grooming ring in Bristol. Could another Rotherham be waiting to happen here? Worth saying also that if you or a friend or a loved one has been a victim of abuse, do please talk to trusted friends and, of course, go to your community police officers who, post Jimmy Savile, now take these sorts of allegations much more seriously. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Lows of 10 degrees Celsius and some showers tonight. This weekend, highs of 13 Celsius, sunshine and showers on Saturday, cloudier but drier on Sunday. Next week, highs of 11, sunshine and showers and windier midweek on. Next weekend, that's the 22nd and 23rd of November, highs of 7, getting pretty cool but fairly sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news, it's Assistant Mayor and Green Party Councillor for Ashley Ward, Gus Hoyt. Hi, Gus, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening.
Also joining us is Martin Fodor, who's a Redland Green Councillor too. Hi, Martin.
Good evening.
Now, first of all, let's talk to you, Martin Fodor, because we had quite a long discussion last week about this Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. It seems like a massively important trade deal that's going on. Very little was reported in Bristol about it across, but it was a big week, wasn't it? Because we had a public meeting last weekend, and I think it was Wednesday this week. The big banks and the people who are pushing this came to Bristol, and you were there. So tell us why you decided to get involved.
Yes, well, I attended the big debate at the Wills Building with, I don't know, about 600 people there the other day.
About 750, yeah.
Up to that capacity, yes. It was quite full. And there were three local MPs from the three parties in the current and previous government. There was our Green MEP, Molly Scott-Cato, for the region. And someone from the trade union, someone from Friends of the Earth, and someone from Positive Money.
What floats this your boat about the TTIP? Why do you think it's important?
I think it is very important. I've worked, for instance, in public procurement, both locally and nationally, over the years, and the impacts of a potential trade deal on public contracts could be quite significant when we hear of what's been called the investor-state dispute mechanism, the resolution mechanism that could allow an investor whose potential future profits are likely to be affected by something that the elected government actually brings in, that could then influence whether or not they get a future contract, and so that they could sue our government for that future profit they haven't made because they haven't got that contract yet.
Well, this is one of the reasons I'm saying, well, is there any point in us voting after that? If we vote in a government to do something and then they're taken to court and told they can't do it, it makes voting seem a little bit pointless. But anyway, so the meeting that took place at the weekend on Saturday, that was a public meeting. But that Wednesday was not a public meeting. Certainly members of the public could not wander in.
No,
so what was going on there?
That was an invitation-only event in what's called the TTIP Roadshow, hosted by Grant Thornton and organised with our own government department, BIS, and with British American Business, which is actually part of the US Embassy promoting US trade to Britain. And in fact, we had I was chatting afterwards to one of the US trade negotiators who said she's been spending her time in Brussels as part of the US trade negotiation delegation. And we had someone from the CBI, Southwest, and also one of their lobbyists from Brussels. But it was an invited business audience. I was able to attend, luckily, because our member of the European Parliament, Molly Scott-Cato, was invited. So I was able to attend through that invitation.
So give us an insider's view. What was actually going on inside the meeting?
It was interesting because just informally beforehand, one of the CBI organisers said she was disappointed there wasn't a placard with her face on it and the word evil, because in Liverpool, a similar business seminar had placards outside criticising the people taking part. But the discussion was very much framed around, we need businesses to say how positive this will be, what they'll get out of it, why they need more of a trade agreement because of barriers to trade and obstacles to them doing business across the Atlantic. And it was framed around the fact that they weren't looking for harmonisation, but they were looking for mutual recognition of regulations. And that worried me enormously. What does mutual recognition of regulations that are actually different mean?
But surely businesses do want to have these kind of access to other markets. That means that Bristol businesses can be more successful if they can sell stuff more easily around the world.
Of course they could, and there was a textile designer from this area who has started to export to the USA and described how it would be nice if some of the obstacles around customs declarations and so on, and flame tests for textile kind of safety were harmonised or were simpler for her to do that business. Or indeed, if she could invest there and get the production of her textiles in that country with other suppliers and not have to actually export them, which means it would only be her designs she was exporting.
Well, that sounds good then. So what's the problem with this agreement?
It could be, but actually, if there is the need for something that doesn't have to be in the way, an actual regulation that could be simplified, I don't necessarily see a problem. But if you take away a stronger regulation by saying it's equivalent to a weaker regulation, I do have a big problem. You know, for instance, we've passed a resolution locally on the living wage here, and we might want all our contractors to bring that in from a certain date. And if another investor or contractor from an international business says, that's taking away my profits, that's threatening my business, I would have a problem because we've agreed that locally.
Well, I start to understand. It really means that the decision is being made further and further away from Bristol, doesn't it?
Well, also the potential for the biggest businesses who have the biggest law teams to use a very secretive, not a normal legal mechanism, but an investor state dispute mechanism. That's some special panel that meets somewhere else, that they could go to that and challenge our government or our local authority.
Some might say a kangaroo court, actually, if possibly. It's been organised by the same people who put together TTIP. Who is it that's pushing this, then, internationally?
Well, it's the European Union on behalf of Europe, because the Commission has the competence for trade, but they are directed by the member state governments. So our government will be pushing it, and they have been, and Biz has been on the case promoting it. And the US federal government, who did acknowledge, their representative from their embassy acknowledged that sometimes it's their states, that their individual states have their own barriers, which stop non-local businesses winning contracts, for instance.
So are there banks behind this as well? I mean, Grant Thornton's an accountant, isn't it? And I think there are quite a lot of people that question how honest these accountants are nowadays, but especially when we've seen the accounts for the big banks signed off pre-2008, only to find in 2008, oopsie-daisy, the accounts weren't worth the paper they were written on.
Yes, that's quite worrying. Well, I'm sure Grant Thornton are looking for business opportunities, and they welcomed us all there because of that. And I'm sure they can advise people on sort of trade and exports. But it, you know, our government, the US Embassy, the CBI, an American business, UPS, were represented. Their policy director, who would like to see it simpler to move packages around the world, I'm sure.
Okay. What about locally? Who was inviting businesses locally, and who were promoting it locally? Because it's nice to see. It's interesting to get your head around this. You've got to see, I think, what's going on internationally, who's organising it internationally, and who is it locally that's sending out the invites, getting people in to Grant Thornton?
Well, locally, certainly taking part locally, because I don't know who actually suggested the invitation list, but the Institute of Directors, Richard Eyre, was there. Business West was represented. The Federation of Small Businesses had a couple of delegates, I believe. Well, several delegates, I believe. And a number of companies from the area. And certainly one or two banks are on the list.
Which banks?
RBS had a representative. Yeah, that's
using our bailout money to do this kind of thing.
Couldn't comment on that. And Deloitte, the another accountant's. Phil Smith from Business West, I did mention them. The office of Claire Moody MEP were represented, I believe.
Okay.
And then a number of companies.
Now, you mentioned small businesses too, but it does seem to me that this whole agenda is being pushed by big business. So what interest do small businesses have? Because surely big businesses, their whole job is they want to monopolise, they want to push the small businesses out.
Well, certainly, if you consider the dominance of the largest businesses, it's something that would open it up to smaller local firms to get their wonderful product or services around the world would arguably be a great thing. We'd like Bristol businesses to thrive. When there are barriers to trade, genuine barriers to trade, that's fine. But removing non-tariff barriers, removing things like the regulations we have locally that might be higher. If Northern European regulations or European environmental regulations or social protection are weakened because some other place is deemed to have equivalent but actually different regulations, and that's a question I actually asked on the day, and they assured me it wasn't about harmonisation, it was about mutual recognition. But I do have a worry about that, because a small business that's working to high environmental standards will not get more opportunities if they're competing in an arena where there might be lower environmental standards.
Look, you're a city councillor, Green City Councillor for Redland. What relevance does this have to Redland small businesses there?
Well, I would certainly hope Redland businesses, there'll be many people with small businesses and intellectual property and services they offer who might get opportunities well beyond Bristol. And, you know, I thoroughly welcome that. But if they're faced with an international system that brings us down to the lowest common denominator, I would be very worried, because actually in our area we want high environmental standards. There's clearly a quality of environment here, and there are protections for workforce, for the environment and so on, which I think are really important. They're part of the fabric of our quality of life.
Okay, Martin Fodor, thanks ever so much for coming in and giving us an inside view of what was going on in that meeting, which the public was shut out of, even though it's about all of our future, down at Grant Thornton.
That's right.
And we're going to hear, before we hear from Gus and his thoughts about Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership, which has been a big thing this week in the city, we're going to hear from the Conservative MP for Bristol North West, Charlotte Leslie, her thoughts on it from the public meeting, which was last weekend.
Put your hands up if you're a bit worried about how much Christmas is going to cost. Phones, clothes that we haven't made, things that we're wearing are a result of trade. And I think what's very interesting about the TTIP debate is it's a question of what do we want trade to be? Where do we want trade to be in our lives? And I think it is an interesting debate that is dividing people, as we can see, because the hall's very, very full. Now, I understand that lots of people in the audience aren't going to agree with me on this, but I am for trade.
Gus, what do you make of that?
Well, quite a lot, actually, Tony. What do we want trade to be for? That's a question which we really need to be asking all the time. And I don't think loosening regulations, racing to the absolute bottom is the way forwards for this. Martin earlier on picked up, you know, what happens if we want to have living wage or environmental considerations built into procurement. Going forward with the TTIP agenda, essentially it opens us up for litigation to be sued by corporations. It's taking the power away from the people and giving them to the corporations. And I think, you know, we can very much see that in the invitee list on the Wednesday meeting.
Do
we want trade to be for? We want much more of a local economy. We want to, you know, invest in, you know, the Redland businesses which Martin spoke of. You know, they don't need to invest, you know, always export to America. There's a huge market here in the UK and here in Bristol.
Has anyone jumps out to you on that invitee list that gives you cause for concern? Because we know big business is already incredibly powerful, and it seems that big business are sort of inviting the small companies along as well, saying, come and go along with this for the time being, everything will be fine. But actually, they're pushing their own agenda.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be benefiting the small businesses. There might be one or two. And Stephen Williams on the Saturday event used Skype, the Estonian company Skype, as his example. But, you know, he had to go pretty far to, you know, find a small business there, you know, none locally that have benefited so much. You asked, you know, any that jump out there. Well, RBS, certainly. You know, wonder if that's how they're spending our bailout money now. So yes, that's one that certainly jumps out, and it shows, you know, who is actually leading this agenda.
But Charlotte's there is saying, actually what we want is we want good mobile phones, we want cheap mobile phones. There's not a lot made here in Britain, so a good trade agreement will mean we do get cheap mobile phones from all over the world. Well, certainly from the Europe and the US.
Yeah, you've got to ask what things cost. I mean, what's the environmental cost? You know, are you just talking about pounds, or are you talking about, you know, what it costs the environment, what it costs, you know, people working abroad in substandard conditions, you know, mining the elements in the factories itself. So, you know, cost can be, you know, sort of qualified in lots of different ways. And I think just focusing on the, you know, we want to buy the cheapest is, you know, perhaps what she believes in, but it's certainly not what I believe in.
Okay, you also mentioned Stephen Williams. He was there. And so let's have a listen to what he had to say at the public meeting last Saturday, a little clip from there.
It also can need to be approved by President Obama, who I'm guessing most of this audience think is a reasonable person, and the United States Senate. Well, the fact that some people don't tells me something. Well, it will have to be passed by the United States Senate as well. So it's probably going to be, since the formulation of the United Nations, probably the biggest thing the planet has done, that's going to be the most heavily scrutinized thing that world leaders have done together that we've ever seen. I think trade, working with each other, trading at what we're best at with what other people are best at, is the way that the planet has advanced in a peaceful way. I think, obviously, there are details we'll have to look at, but I start, as I often do in politics, from a position of optimism rather than deep pessimism and cynicism.
Well, that's certainly good to have a positive attitude, Martin Summers, old Labour Oxford economist. But what did you make of Stephen Williams' contribution?
Well, I mean, he was saying let's be optimistic and that we will negotiate from a position of strength as Europe, because he's very pro the European Union. But of course, European Union financial regulations are in fact weaker than financial regulations in the US. So it's, as John Hillary from War on Want pointed out in a presentation, film presentation at the beginning of the meeting, this isn't really US versus Europe. It's more big business capital versus society. So in the US, the financial services sector wants the deal because it will allow EU regulations on financial services to take precedence, and they're actually weaker than the kind of thing that's found in the US. So what will happen is that wherever the regulations are weakest, that's where the benefits will come.
But we hear a lot of talk about regulations, this kind of thing, deregulation or regulations. What's this got to do with politics?
Well, all markets are regulated. There's no such thing as a free market. All markets are based upon the fact that private property exists, for example, and that there's some legal basis for private property. If there's no legal basis for private property, I can just steal things off other people and they've got no right to complain. So all markets are regulated. The question is what the regulations should be. And I think what we've learned, surely, over the last 4 or 5 years is that deregulations in the financial markets have been absolutely disastrous. I would argue that virtually everything that we've done in financial services since the 1980s and the Big Bang has basically been wrong. The regulations that were put in place in the 1930s, for example, to keep casino banking and retail banking separate, were there for a reason. And when they were removed, we then created the rod for our backs, which we're now suffering. And the idea that the less regulation there is, the better, is very much a kind of propaganda of the powerful. Regulations are there to protect very, very important social values, and not least, of course, preventing the financial services sector from aggrandizing massive wealth and power and then crushing the economy, as has happened.
One of the organisations that's fighting against that is something which formed very recently called the CME Alliance, SME Alliance, sorry, Small Medium Enterprise Alliance. It started 2 months ago but already has 40 members, all of them small business owners who say the big four banks have deliberately bankrupted them, mostly by imposing what they say are illegal charges, then pursuing their borrowers through the courts until they're forced to go bankrupt. They've been looking carefully at two Bristol-based firms, Acorn Farm Finance and Burgess Salmon, and two specific people, Solicitor Peter Williams and LLP receiver Nick Bird. Many members of the SME Alliance were horrified to find banks giving them so-called bank managers to advise them, who were in fact receivers. So right from the start, without them knowing, they say they were being given bad advice by people using their experience in bankruptcy law to trip them up and take all their assets. The other problem is bank employees were awarded enormous bonuses if they manage to strip the business of its assets. Now, this financial services problem, we've had another example, Martin, this week, haven't we, of the foreign exchange fraud actually being settled out of court.
Yes, and of course, when organisations are fined what sound like lots of money, but are in actual fact a fraction of the money that they've gained through illegal activity, and no individuals are held responsible, then that basically is a green light for fraud. And the idea that somehow the financial services sector is under control and that lessons have been learned and all the rest of it is poppycock. In actual fact, the derivatives market now is bigger by several orders of magnitude than it was in 2008, and I'm pretty confident that there is going to be another major crash. Whether it happens before the general election in Britain or after is a moot point, but it's definitely going to happen in my view.
Gus Hoyt, you're in the cabinet on the City Council with Mayor Ferguson, and you're a Green councillor in Ashley Ward. What's your thoughts about this? Because I'm horrified to hear that people we've bailed out these banks in 2008, but what they seem to be doing, at least some of them, is actually using the power they have over the debts that people hold in order to take people to court, and then they're fined. Say, for example, they want to change the terms of a loan. They want to pay off their loan early. They find that actually they're then taken to court and say, well, you've got to pay a massive fine for changing the terms of the repayments of your loan, and people have been bankrupted. So what can people do in the face of this? Because it all seems as if this has been done by a legal route.
Well, if I may, and I'll be a bit cheeky, I'll say the first thing they can do is vote Green in general elections, because you've got to change the people making these laws. But I mean, basically, it's because our whole economy is based on this boom and bust theory. You know, Martin just now said he's pretty sure another crash is coming. Of course it will. It has to. It's the way our economy is built up. You know, it is based around the debt economy. Wealth is created through debt in this country. Well, not just
this
country,
but
I mean,
surely the more the banks are putting people, individual businesses into debt, they're acquiring more and more assets all the time. They're not going to allow the economy to crash in that state.
Well, you know, if they do, they'll just bail themselves out again, really, at the end of the day. But, you know, it does need fundamental changes to the laws. You know, the legislation is in favour of the big banks. It is in favour of the large corporations. You know, going back to TTIP, which we were talking about earlier, you know, that's just going to push the boat out even further.
Let's hear now, anyway, from Nigel Henderson. He's a Scottish hotelier. He's part of this SME alliance, and he found that the arrangements that, where he tried to pay down a loan led to him losing everything.
Nigel Henderson, hotelier or ex-hotelier from Scotland. We became customers of RBS in 1997, having been in business nearly 30 years. We were assured that we could take out loans, fixed rate loans, on the basis of residential mortgage type loans, which we expected to repay within 7 to 10 years at the latest. RBS drew up loan agreements, assured us that within those agreements was the basis for making early redemption. 17 months after taking out the loans, we sold one of our hotels and deposited nearly £1 million in cash and instructed the bank to repay the loans of £800,000 that we had for our remaining hotel. They hit us with a demand for £240,000 to make the repayment. This was in December 1998. I couldn't accept that that was a recognisable figure and a feasible figure, given that we'd been assured 3 months' interest. And they took the cash on deposit, secured it by a letter of pledge they demanded we sign, and refused to put any cash towards the reduction of the debt. And within 4 years, they bankrupted us and took everything from us. We had two hotels when we became customers of RBS. We sold one, which we'd had for 15 years and was our most profitable hotel, making profits of over £300,000 in that hotel, and that was the cash cow for supporting the loan.
So you were doing something that you thought was prudent, paying down the loan early, slimming down a little bit, maybe moving on in life. You think, well, we don't necessarily want the trouble of managing two hotels. But how on earth did they manage to bankrupt you? Because it sounds to me as if you should be now quite happily sitting there with one hotel and having paid off all your loans.
Well, one would have thought so. It was an unsolicited offer we got for... We had two hotels, a Park Hotel at Montrose, which we'd had for a long time, and we bought the Portree Hotel in Portree in the Isle of Skye. We got an unsolicited offer for the Park Hotel, which was 50% higher than the valuation placed on it the year before when we became customers of RBS. We were given very strong advice from all our professional advisors to accept the offer because we were aged 50 at that time, and we would not have had to pay any capital gains tax on the uplift in value. That was the reason that we sold, and the only reason that we sold, and we expected to roll that cash and profit over onto a replacement hotel. But in the first instance, we wanted to clear our loans completely, and that's when RBS refused to take the cash on deposit and clear the loans.
That is very strange, isn't it? You would have thought that if you want to repay a loan, a lender would allow you to do that. Isn't that kind of what they're there for?
Well, I was always brought up that cash is king. And if you've cash, what's the point in having it on deposit when it can be used more profitably to reduce your exposure, particularly when we're paying 10.22% interest?
Okay, so what excuses did they use?
They said that we had to pay the breakage fee. And the breakage fee, they gave us all sorts of figures. It started off at $240,000. We got one figure of $36,000. We got one figure of $42,000.
Hang on, they're plucking these figures out of the air.
Precisely. And when I got the one in writing to say that it was $42,000, I wrote to them and said that I would accept the breakage fee of $42,000 and repay the loans. And they turned round and put in writing that the breakage fee had increased by £12,000 or thereabouts over the period since they had got it, the fee, from the Treasury Department 4 days before they met with me, when they could have told me at that time that they'd got a breakage fee, and they didn't tell me until another 5 days after that. So it was 2 weeks out of date, just about, by the time I got it.
So a proprietor of two large hotels, quite prestigious hotels in Scotland, what's your situation now?
Right now we're living on, pensioners, my wife and I are living in state pension. We live in a rented house and we get a housing benefit to assist us with our rent, having gone from a £2.5 million business in 1998. We were bankrupted, as I say, in 2002. And still with hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pounds in deposit on the bank, which they refused to use for our benefit.
So what would you like to see done about all this? Because it's obviously this is a systemic problem with our banking system. It's not just about your case.
It's not about our case, but one thing that has come out clear in the last, 2002, as I say, since we were bankrupted and have been fighting since then. And one thing that has been very clear is that RBS particularly engage in fraud. And I've been told that by a forensic accountant as well as by the police. And we're currently pursuing a potential criminal investigation with the Crown Office in Edinburgh to encourage them to pursue RBS for fraud.
Ultimately, a bank and money is a kind of a utility. A country needs it, needs to have trust in it in order to carry on and survive. Is there any possibility, do you think, that we might get to a system whereby people can trust the banks again to actually be supplying those services like loans at cost rather than some kind of massive profit to pay off an almost unpayable debt?
I would like to think that banking would revert back to the days it used to be up until the mid-1980s or early 1990s. I have doubts about it, given the swathes of debt that there is in the financial system throughout the Western world. And there is also an endemic problem of the bonus culture, whereby as long as people are being incentivized to sell totally unsuitable products for customers just so that they can increase their own personal earnings, the banking system will never be cleaned up. There's got to be a root and branch change, and I think the banking system has to revert to the old days where there is much more competition in the market and they are more localised. Personal opinion, but I know that opinion is shared by many other people I speak to.
So is that going to happen? That's the $64,000 question, isn't it?
The politicians know of the problems, financial problems, there is within the banking system. And it is not in their best interests or the Treasury's best interests to see much change in the banking system in the medium to long term, I believe, because of the debt that is there. And it's going to take decades, I believe, to be sorted out.
But it surely may be never sorted out, because we're at, I think, 1.3 trillion national debt, and it's going up at a rate of knots. Osborne is saying he's trying to reduce the deficit. It's not, it's increasing.
That's correct. That's the national debt. But what about the debt in the banking system, which is anything of an equivalent amount if you take RBS itself? I believe RBS is hopelessly insolvent.
If you're painting a picture of a sort of terminal decline of the nation brought about by this banking fraud.
I believe that that is a true reflection of the fact.
Okay, so what can we do about it?
I think honesty and integrity, if it were feasible, I think some of the banks should be allowed to fail. That would clear out the system. It would be a very hard lesson and a very hard shock. But far better to have a short, sharp shock and start again than to drag it out over decades, and I believe it is decades that will continue.
Yeah, the problem with short, sharp shock is it's not short, and it's not even sharp, it's terminal. The reason why governments bailed the banks out in 2008, because the alternative of allowing them to collapse was seen as no alternative. I think that's, unfortunately, that is the case. Because if the banks had collapsed, the capitalism won't just spontaneously regenerate. That the chap who's speaking there, he's got to face up to the fact that he would lose his business and all of his assets, and then so would lots of other people. And out of that wouldn't come a leaner, meaner capitalism. Well, out of that would come a social breakdown, which is why the banks were bailed out. But once you bail the banks out, there is no excuse whatsoever for continuing to indulge them. And that's what's gone wrong. There's not been a political will to deal firmly with the banks. So, for example, to put RBS through a bankruptcy procedure to make sure that the shareholders and the leaders of the bank were all bankrupted and lose all of their assets, and all of their assets are forfeit, and several people go to prison for 20-25 years.
Isn't it quite simple to allow a bank to, or in fact even encourage a bank to fail, to take away its licence, for example? Then that might mean that all of the investors, that is the shareholders in that bank, lose that money, but the depositors don't.
Yeah, well, what you should have done is protected the depositors up to a certain level and burned all of the shareholders and the managers. But what happened was we bailed the banks out, and then the banks turned around and used the bailout money to carry on lobbying for further juice to be trickled in their direction. There was no critique of capitalism, which was running at the time of the banking crash, which would have allowed a Labour government to say, right, you've really blotted your copybook now, we're going to nationalise you and make a big point of nationalising them, and then also we're now taking control of this situation and we're going to put some of you in prison, we're going to steal. We could have closed the national debt by taking back the assets which have been stolen by the bankers. That would solve the problems without any bedroom taxes or anything else. But the will simply wasn't there.
Gus?
Yeah, well, I mean, Martin's just hit the nail on the head, really, hasn't he? I mean, you know, again, white-collar crime has gone unprosecuted. Went after the wrong people, or prosecuted the wrong people, or just, passed the debt on to, you know, the people of this country instead of all the people that made the money.
But I mean, you're sitting there in the cabinet with Mayor Ferguson, who does have the ear of more, there's quite a lot of people in Whitehall and Westminster. Why are we not hearing Bristol shouting more loudly about this? This week again, foreign exchange fraud has been, you can't really quite say unpunished, but actually the fines are derisory. Certainly nobody's been taken to court, nobody's going to prison, and there's going to be no blot or criminal records for any of those traders who've committed that fraud. So why isn't Bristol shouting about this? I mean, we're paying vast amounts of taxation to Westminster, which is all being used, it seems, to repay banks, to the repay loans to these crooked banks.
Yeah, you know, and I think we should be, really, but whenever George has been questioned, you know, Councillor Rob Telford calls him up on it a few times about national or international issues. He refuses to comment because basically he doesn't have that in his remit, and that's the excuse given. And basically, you know, as the mayor of Bristol, he doesn't have any financial regulatory powers.
But he has a voice.
He certainly does, but he chooses not to use it in that way.
Can I say, I think that is what's wrong with the localism agenda as a whole. Bristol is a major player in national politics in Britain. In the Civil War, it changed hands three times.
Yeah.
And George Ferguson's localist approach is ultimately idiotic. I mean, the mayor of Bristol is a national political figure. He can't just say, I'm not taking positions on national affairs. I mean, the cuts which we're having to make in Bristol are because of national policy from Westminster. And we ought to be saying, even if we're making them, we don't believe in these cuts. But he won't do that because, and this is the problem with localism per se, I think. And localism can just become a kind of head in the sand localism where you're not taking a notice of things that are happening nationally or internationally. There's going to be an international banking collapse. What's that going to do for Bristol's resilience? I mean, I know he's involved in these resilience discussions, but nevertheless, it always seems to be a kind of worm's eye view with George. He doesn't really engage with national political issues.
Onto a story from the local paper, the Bristol Post. Bristol City Council accused of racism by a black development worker. That was Wednesday this week. A black development worker who won race discrimination damages from a Bristol school has accused the City Council of being institutionally racist. David McLeod, 38, was working at the City Academy, that's right where we are now, but was overlooked for promotion in 2012. Mr. McLeod made the claim to Bristol 24/7 after hearing the Academy's former principal Jill Kelly had been hired by the council. The authority said it employed Mrs. Kelly for her extensive experience. Mrs. Kelly is providing consultancy 2 days a week until July on a project which was open to all Bristol secondary head teachers. While she was a principal at the Academy, Mr. McLeod was working on a project designed to help black and ethnic minority students improve their academic achievements, but an investigation into practices at the school found he and other black staff on the project were passed over for promotion while three white managers were appointed. I'd like you to answer this actually, Gus. It seems that there still is this undercurrent of racism around, and this is an employment tribunal that's saying that, not me.
Yeah, institutional racism is very real, and it is very dangerous because people don't always recognise it as racism. It's just, people come up with all kinds of excuses for it. There is literally none. I've met David a couple of times actually, and his case is very valid and has been proven. I don't actually know the details around Miss Kelly's employment, so I can't really comment on that one. But yes, it is, it is alarming.
The City Academy have said lessons have been learned. Martin, what are your thoughts about this case? Someone is employed specially to help black and ethnic minority people finds themselves actually discriminated against by white people.
Well, I mean, I presume that the legal process that's been gone through here is satisfactory and the case has been proven. I think institutional racism often comes because people stick to bureaucratic procedures which they don't recognise as being racist, even though they are. So there's criteria on a particular job description or whatever, which basically excludes certain people, but it's not overt exclusion. And even the people who are doing the excluding are not aware that they're choosing people like them to do the jobs that they're giving away.
Just on the legal side, he has been awarded £14,000 in damages.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously the case has been proven, and the City Academy, as you say, this is where we're sitting at the moment. They will have to take on board what the courts have said and try to improve their procedures. But I mean, the fact is that these procedures, we are dealing with these issues because we're talking about them now. It's not being brushed under the carpet. Let's make sure we don't brush it under the carpet.
Okay, well, let's go back to Monday now. Monday was a very special day down at Bristol Cathedral. It wasn't in their diary, but it was the charter day service for the Merchant Venture. Cathedral full of 500 school children from Colston Girls School, Merchants Academy, I'm not sure, but possibly Colston Boys School as well. And I managed to secrete myself into the private service. There were lots of other people waiting to visit the cathedral, kept waiting outside until the service was over. And without really knowing what to expect, I thought, well, let's have I should record the sermon. And I did. And I was quite horrified halfway through the sermon to find Bishop Michael Hill of Bristol in his sermon saying to these 500 school children and teachers from the schools, the merchants' sponsor, that Edward Colston had business dealings and that there was questions about his business dealings, but those were just speculation. So anyway, Radio Bristol had Bishop Michael on earlier this week. So let's have a listen now to BBC Radio Bristol's breakfast show, a short excerpt from that, where Steve Lefebvre actually asks Bishop Michael what he really meant, whether he really did think that Edward Colston, the former merchant venturer's involvement in the slave trade, was actually speculation.
I was in front of a congregation, as you say, that had three schools in it, and two of them indirectly benefited from the benefaction that Colston left behind him.
Why is that speculation, Bishop Mike? There is no question, is there, that he was an official of Let me just finish the question.
Yeah.
There's no question that he was an official of the Royal Africa Company, which had the monopoly on slave trading at that time. It could be questionable if he used ill-gotten gains to be philanthropic for the city. But there's no question of what he was involved with, is there?
I don't think so personally, but there are people, as you know, who do think that.
Are there?
Yeah, I think there are.
Who thinks that? Who thinks that he was not involved in slavery?
I have had it said to me by individual. What has been said to me, not that he wasn't involved, but that his personal involvement was not what it's been cracked up to be by some of the people who speak about slavery?
I mean, just looking at, I don't know, the BBC history, which says that, that the monopoly of his money came from slave trading. Okay. Even the history of Parliament website, which tells us, indeed, the same thing, that, that in 1680 became heavily involved in the slave trade, from which he made the bulk of his fortune. That's pretty unequivocal, isn't it?
Yes, I wasn't really speculating about the history of it. I was speculating, as I say, about the fact that, you know, around him is this controversy. Was he a philanthropist? How does the world look at him? I was trying to say to 500 children, actually what I was trying to say to them is, look, there's a bigger world, and there, you know, some people see a bigger picture.
Well, yeah, he seemed to be given a shovel and dug himself a bit deeper on that one. I'm not sure why he keeps saying speculating. We all know that Colston was a slaver. You know, this city has two very shameful aspects to it. One of which is, has built a great deal of it. One of which is the slave trade, and the other, of course, is the tobacco industry. I'm, really not sure why anyone would try and deny that Colston was involved in slavery. You know, I don't think we should reinvent history. I don't think we should try and bury it. I think we should be very, very clear about exactly what happened.
Do you think it's appropriate, Gus, to have secondary schools named after Edward Colston still? I mean, there's obviously been quite a lot of controversy about Colston Hall, for example.
Yeah, and people want to change the name of the streets around the city as well. Personally speaking, like I say, I don't think you should rewrite history. You know, he has set up the money, originally his trust funds are built, paying for schools now. I don't think we should necessarily just, rename the schools, but I think they should know exactly, where their benefactor got his money from.
I mean, I can remember back, I think it was 2008 when we had the 200th anniversary of the abolition of slavery.
Yeah.
There was a fantastic exhibition down at the Empire and Commonwealth Museum at Temple Meads, which, I mean, actually spent most of the day in there, and it was a warts and all. You know, this is really what it was like, and it was pretty horrific. Most scholars agree something like 8 million prisoners, slaves, perished on the crossing across the Atlantic, the Middle Passage, which of course was kept very separate from Bristol, even though the profits were made in Bristol. And I just wonder what you think would be an appropriate way of remembering that in the city in some way, because there were calls for some kind of memorial in 2008, which was never came to fruition.
Yeah, and that debate's still raging, isn't it? Should we have a very honest memorial to all the lives lost through slavery? As you say, millions have died. Millions died during that despicable industry. And I think Bristol very much, because we had a part to play in it. I think we have a part to ensuring that future slavery as well, or present slavery which exists. We have a very strong role in tackling that all around the world. I think we have an international responsibility for that.
Old Abel Oxford economist Martin Summers, what are your thoughts about the Bishop's comments? Because he did think that he was talking to a captive audience, a private service, where no one would certainly be reporting on it or recording.
Well, yes, and I think he's just basically his remarks aren't really defensible. You could see him just chasing his own tail there. I would tend to agree with Gus that changing the name of Colston Hall or taking Colston's statue down or changing the name of schools, that in a way is trying to whitewash history. We might as well use the name and then use the fact that Colston was a slave owner to educate the future generation about what it was all about and not to hide
but
it under,
being
under,
here,
under
really,
a bushel.
That the merchant venturers do have a very privileged position in the city still, the same organisation that was profiting from the slave trade back in those times. And they aren't open about their books. One of the things I discovered when I was digging into them this week was that because they've got a royal charter, they don't have to file accounts at Companies House, so that the investments that they make are secret. There really is it's very difficult to find out. I mean, we know that they're from past investigations that they have big investments in things like utility companies and the oil industry. I just wonder, maybe they've got some spare cash to do something, to actually say, well, meaningful, to create some sort of a permanent memorial to those that died at their own hands. And I think people would maybe take them a bit more seriously.
Well, yes, I think it's quite clear that what was going on at this private religious service in a public building was basically a whitewash of the history of the merchant venturers for a younger generation that deserve a better and more balanced account of what actually happened. And I'm afraid that if the merchant venturers carry on and the bishop, you know, suborning bishops to kind of justify their historical record, then there is going to be controversy about it, and it's going to be all over the media as it is at this very moment.
Okay, more than half of British people believe religion does more harm than good. And whilst we're on the subject of Bristol Cathedral, says a survey, the majority, more than half of people in the UK believe religion does more harm than good, whilst less than a quarter believe faith is a force for good, a new survey has revealed. And the viewpoint even applies to those with strong faith. One-fifth, 20% of Britons who describe themselves as being very religious said religion was harmful to society. The findings from the study for the Huffington Post, which was carried out by Servation, challenge widely held views about religion and its place in modern British society. Well, I think it's pretty obvious to say that the bishop has not done a great job selling religion this week. So anyway, Gus, what are your thoughts about this survey?
I think it's very interesting, actually, Tony, but I'll just speak from personal experience, really. I mean, my dad was brought up a Catholic, and as soon as he was old enough, he left the faith. And when my mum was suffering from postnatal depression after the birth of my sister, she was essentially told by the wife of the vicar, who is the village GP, that it was down to a lack of faith that she was feeling that way. So I've never personally had a strong connection. I know it helps out a great deal of people, but I also grew up in the 1980s when the troubles over in Ireland was all over the news. So to me, growing up as a small child, religion kind of meant conflict.
Martin?
Well, I think it's religious beliefs are well nigh universal in human societies throughout history. Most people, when they're in trouble, will have a go at praying to whatever they've been brought up to pray to. I don't think we get anywhere by having black and white views about things like this. Religion has quite clearly been used as a source of conflict over the centuries. But then those who were most anti-religious, like the French and Russian revolutionaries, then went around in their atheistical way, just showed that you don't need to have a god to be a monstrous person. I think what we really need to do is develop a humanistic ethics which values everything about human beings, including their propensity to religious belief, which should be accepted and worked with. But of course, when people make silly remarks about slavery, then they need to be brought up about it.
Okay, another story this week. Abuse campaigners are not conspiracy theorists, Mr. Cameron. This is Will Black writing in The Independent. George Orwell's novel 1984, he writes, in the end, the party would announce that 2 and 2 made 5, and you would have to believe it. It was inevitable that they should make that claim sooner or later. The logic of their position demanded it. Now, I'm talking, of course, about the Wanless report into the 144 disappeared files about institutional child abuse in Britain, which was the report was delivered on Tuesday this week. And yet David Cameron said called some of these abuse people who were campaigning for the child abuse inquiry conspiracy theorists. There's obviously been a little bit of a backlash, not just in The Independent, but amongst abuse campaigners themselves, saying they don't believe David Cameron is serious about getting to the bottom of this. Anyway, Gus, what are your thoughts about this inquiry and the fact that from the 1980s, this dossier, which was handed to the Home Secretary Leon Britton by, I think it was Geoffrey Dickens, MP, has gone missing, and yet we hear this week that although we know the names of the files, that Wanless has managed to find them, all of that information seems to have disappeared.
Well, I'd imagine Cameron's probably going to call me a conspiracy theorist, but this is just basically complete evidence of the ruling class looking after their own. There's no other way to dress this one up.
Martin?
Well, I'd just like to pick on the term conspiracy theory. The word conspiracy theory was originally used by the CIA in relation to theories about the JFK assassination, which were originally called in the media assassination theories. That was really problematic from the point of view of the CIA, so they pushed through the US media the whole concept of conspiracy theory, which is now used, of course, to criticise anybody who suggests that there's any kind of planning goes into what ruling class and other well-connected groups get up to. So the use of language is a means of trying to control debate.
What about this oneness report? Do you think it's really discovered very much this week? Because he's basically saying, yes, we know that what these... I mean, in fact, it's the first time we've had the names of what was in these reports. The actual titles of the files weren't being released under Freedom of Information requests, but now we have them. That seems about it this week.
Well, I think the evidence that the paedophile networks have been used for elite. I think the point people have got to get is blackmail of senior figures. So the Kinkora Boys Home in Northern Ireland, which has been excluded from this investigation, evidence dating back 20, 30 years, was used by the intelligence services as a honey trap. So people were having sex with underage boys, mostly loyalist paramilitaries, for purposes of political blackmail. And Ken Livingstone made his maiden speech about this when he was elected for Brent East in the 1990s, I think it was, in Parliament. So clearly something's going on here, but people need to think of it not just as bad behaviour, but as bad behaviour with a purpose, for purposes of political blackmail.
Well, we had the senator from Jersey, Stuart Siveray, on here a couple of months ago, didn't we, talking yeah. about this, and he was saying that they had identified officials in Jersey who were appointed by the Crown who were covering up abuse, that is people with mental health problems and people who've been abused, actually locked up in prison cells and that sort of thing. And he said that they got absolutely no traction at all from the royal family. So it was quite disturbing to hear on Tuesday this week that again, the finger is pointing at Buckingham Palace. And this is a report which was on the PM programme on Radio 4 with Danny Shaw.
I recommend anyone that sees the report to have a look at the annexes and the appendices, because they do contain some interesting information. I was particularly struck by some of the relevant files that the review examined, and there was one which says it contained allegations of paedophilia at Buckingham Palace. Now, this information was contained in the Geoffrey Dickens dossier and was referred to in a letter from the then Home Secretary Leon Britton to Mr. Dickens, in which he talks about a 16-year-old youth who has apparently made the allegations, and Leon Britton replies that there would be substantial obstacles in the way of a detailed investigation, though he said that the royal household was extremely concerned at the allegations.
Well, yes, the royal household concerned at the allegations, but it doesn't seem anything was ever done about it. This is again another indication that some of this abuse seems to go right to the top, and that people at the very, very top echelons, the top apex of society, seem to be totally above the law.
Well, yes, and the purpose, I would stress again that the purpose of entrapping people in these kind of paedophile networks is to ensure certain political outcomes. So the Kinkora Boys Home, which was a publicly run institution, was being used by the intelligence services to entrap, political entrapment of people they wanted to target. But the welfare of the young people concerned had no kind of bearing on the situation at all. And I think that all of these things are linked. The Dutroux affair in Belgium implied similar things going on. I think the real problem is that we've got an intelligence services which are completely out of control and using things like paedophilia as one of the tools in the box.
Well, what we've heard last weekend, it was revealed on the XRO news website that Sir Peter Hayman, who was the deputy head of MI6, was actually
Indeed.
A child abuser.
Indeed.
It seems that we're only their job, surely the intelligence services, is to make sure this sort of thing doesn't happen, and yet it seems they're actually criminally involved.
No, their job isn't to make sure things like this don't happen. Their job is to actually advance the interests of powerful groups embedded within the state, and they use whatever mechanisms they can. If you are MI6 and you are involved in child abuse, you know pretty much that you're going to get away with it because you can. But also, of course, the evidence seems to suggest that it's been used as a tool by the intelligence services, just as terrorism has been used, and that's what we need to get to the bottom of.
Okay, well, more about this after the Murdoch news at 6 o'clock. Thanks to this week's guests, that's Assistant Mayor and Green Party councillor for Ashley Ward, Gus Hoyt, and also Green Party councillor for Redland, Martin Fodor. After the news, Tim Tate, documentary maker from the southwest of England.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.